This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? It is the penultimate interview of our Safety 1, Safety 2 mini-series. Let's jump into the intro, and I'll tell you more about today's guest.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent. What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception of health and safety. So if you're new here, hit those subscribe, follow, whatever buttons that look like they do something good to the algorithm and the social media magic that is today's world. I always tweak that little intro bit and it never just sits right. I need to really nail that down. That needs some work, doesn't it? Anyway, moving on. Today's guest, I would frankly put this lady up there as a legend, a very humble legend, a very modest legend, which makes her more of a legend because she is those two things. She's done some amazing work through the coronavirus kind of lockdown in England, and obviously her audience is way beyond England. She operates internationally. She does some amazing work with her company internationally. But throughout the lockdown period, in the first lockdown and then continued throughout the second lockdown, the third lockdown, or the tiered systems, etc., she's done these webinars focusing on human factors, human and organizational performance, the future of the profession, and just loads and loads of stuff that frankly we need to hear more of in the profession. They were broken into two mini series, well, two mammoth series they should be called, really. The first one was kind of like the founding fathers of human and organizational performance, and the second was Bright Sparks and Disruptors, which yours truly, me, James at Rebranding Safety, was kindly and humbly invited to join that list of absolute legends. So thank you very much to today's guest for that invite. I was very humbled to receive it and I enjoyed every minute of it. And we will put a link down in the description that you can register for these webinars because they are still ongoing now. And as far as I'm aware, she's continuing to do them. She kind of built a rod for her own back. In her normal day job, she runs a company called Paradigm Human Performance. And if you know who I'm talking about. It is Teresa Swinton. As far as I'm concerned, she is up there in those hop legends. And it's really awesome to see one, a woman, and two, an English woman kind of in that space. It's very dominated by America and Australia and dominated by males. So it's really awesome to see Teresa there. And obviously there are other women operating in the space doing some amazing work as well. But I just love what Teresa does with her company, with her webinars, with absolutely everything she's involved in. She's got a real clear kind of sense of why she does things, which we talk about in today's interview as well. So today's interview kind of came randomly with no planning whatsoever. We just had a LinkedIn messaging and we were like, when are we going to do this Zoom call then? We put a Zoom call in the diary and then that was it. We just started waffling. And even to a point when she was like, right, well, what are we going to talk about? And I was like, well, we're already like 50% through the podcast. So it was really emergent. That's my favourite way to do these interviews, but sometimes that doesn't work. But with people like Teresa, you can just sit and talk, and I can definitely just sit and talk to her. So with that being said, there are a lot of things that we talk about then, and we do bounce around a lot of places, talking about her career and talking around, you know, Safety 1 and Safety 2, and we talk about loads and loads of things. But I really thought it sat well in this mini-series for a couple of things. One is her journey from kind of safety professional through to this hop kind of expert, and then her journey from Paradigm, what Paradigm do, and also how they deliver compliance and safety two, or compliance and hop, or safety one and safety two, whatever the bloody hell you want to call it. So we talk about that as well. So that was why I thought it's going in here. So obviously this has took the place of my original plan of last week's interview, not last week's episode, but the last interview, which would have been 2 weeks ago, which was Simon Cassin, and this episode with Teresa Swinton. These came after the original plan, which was to rebroadcast an episode of Tim Marsh and to rebroadcast an episode of Ron Gant. However, I just thought, well, new content's always better, so let's get these in there. So hopefully you enjoy my conversation with Teresa Swinton.
Yeah, we've been out, but mainly, unfortunately, investigating incidents. But apart from that, like you say, you know, just everything is on Zoom now. Even our consultancy work, everything's on here now. I think this is going to be the way of it for the rest of this year, definitely. Yeah.
Have you had much of like a business impact from COVID, or
there's good and bad. Yeah, definitely we've had a massive impact on the business. So pretty much in March when it hit, there was eight of us, we were out in America working. We had a 4-year contract out there with a fairly big company. And literally March, the boom came down. It was like, guys, you've got to go home. And so, you know, then all of our UK work, then within a matter of 5 days, actually, everything just closed down.
Oh, really?
So, it was a real kind of like, shit, what are we going to do, you know?
Yeah.
But, and I think our gut reaction was probably the same as everyone else's, like panic, get everything online.
Yeah.
And we went through a bit of that. But then when I saw some of the stuff that was coming out online in those early days, I was like, I ain't doing that. I ain't going to rush this and do it really crap, you know? So I just said to Gareth and the team, I said, right, scrap it. Let's just take our time. You know, let's see what comes of it, see what our customers want.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, this, you know, the weekly webinar.
Yeah.
That has been... It started off, we were only going to do 4 weeks. It was like four weeks.
Oh, really?
Help our clients. Yeah, that's all it was. We put a panel of eight people together because our customers were ringing us up going, we don't know what the hell to do. You know, what are your other clients doing? So I said, right, we'll put this thing on for 4 weeks. Well, that was April and we're still going.
Still doing that,
and it's
and
just
you've got to schedule all the way up to the new year as well now, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. So it's I love it. Thursday afternoons is like the highlight of my week now.
It is good. I've enjoyed them. And you're getting really good turnout as well. Like there's a lot of people in there.
Yeah. I mean, twice now we've managed to, you know, sort of, because there's 100 in there with your standard Zoom membership. Yeah. So twice now we've managed to sort of break through the 100 where we've got people emailing us and I can't get in. Is it broken? Right. And the first time that happened was when Todd was on. I was on the phone to Gareth going, shit, what's happened? You know, people are emailing me. It was like, we maxed out at 100.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, bloody hell. So
I actually missed that one. That was the one I couldn't go to. And I was like, oh, man. But then I've kind of heard Todd quite a lot. And I actually was interviewing him, I think, a couple of weeks before.
I was going to say,
we've not put that out yet, but we was interviewing him anyway, and I thought, all right then.
Yeah.
But it was a shame. It's always good to listen to Todd speak.
Did you catch Joe on Thursday though?
I had to shoot off bang on through it, a couple of minutes before 3 because I had a call, but he was great. Like,
he's
he
amazing.
Was unbelievable. I loved the way he came at it, and a lot of the stuff that he said really resonated with me, like about communicating the stuff out, which for me is where I think we fall down a lot.
Like, yeah, definitely.
Just actually explaining it in the right language for the right audience and stuff like that. But some of the examples he were giving, I was just sitting there like mind blown. It was crazy.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, he's amazing. I mean, I've heard him speak quite a lot now at different events and online and stuff like that. But I must admit, he saved some gold dust for us. He really did, and that was Even I was having a few tears.
It's good for me as well, your little webinar series, because there's a few on there that I don't know, so I just take their name down, post it on the wall, get this guy on the podcast.
Yeah,
easy peasy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And Joe and Jim Marinas, I mean, they're good value. You know, they are good value. So they've got some good stuff.
I've got Jim's
to
name down as well, actually. I think Adam John's put me onto Jim's radar.
And Adam's a good guy as well, isn't he? You know,
Adam's a legend.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So it's all you youngsters now. Oh, you young man.
I feel old now, if I'm honest, Trees. I'm on that IOSH Future Leaders steering group, right? I'm sure I'm the oldest one there. Like, I feel really
grandpa
old.
The time.
Yeah. Like, I'm the old wise one of the group. Well, I'm old. I don't know about wise.
That's like, I mean, it's completely different now. But when I was approaching 30, I remember it was like a mad race to get on a Club 18:30 holiday.
it's depressing when you go on like the forms and you just watch yourself going up the groups.
Tell
isn't
me
it?
About it, mate. I turned 50 yesterday.
No way.
Yeah. It was my 50th birthday yesterday, and it's like, it's shit. It really is. And some of the forms, you know, they're like 45 to 50, and I like those forms. But when I filled one in the other day, and it went like 40 to 46, 46 to 60. I was like, fuck off, I'm not taking that box. It was so depressing, you know?
You've just lost business on that basis. You're like, no, fuck you. Yeah. I'm not doing business with you. You can piss off a lot of you.
Yeah, you're a saga member.
What was it? Was it your bus pass application?
Yeah, it was my bus pass. Fuck off, James. Don't start that crap with me on here now. Behave yourself. So what are we going to talk about, or is this it? Is this us talking?
Well, this is raw. These are my favorite types of podcasts. People that just say, yeah, just let's get it booked and we'll go on. So we're already recording. So
that was lovely. God, I'll keep my language down then.
No, you're all right. You're right.
Swearing like an old navvy.
Don't worry about, well, unless you're worried about your own kind of brand, but there's no
There's no
swearing on here. We'll just put a little sticker on the thing. Advisory. Yeah, don't worry about it. They're one of my favourite. Well, I really want to do. I was talking to Sam Goodman last night, and I was saying to him, we've mentioned this a few times, but like, did you ever see that series on Channel 4, Drunk History?
Where
the comedians,
they
got absolutely sloshed, and then we'd just talk about history. Well, I think there should be a drunk safety podcast.
I think
once a month, where a few people just get absolutely sloshed, and then once they're drunk, that's when you press record.
Then you interview them.
Yeah,
and then
we just put out a question like, right, you're like 6 pints in and 4 glasses of the rum, and you're like, define safety. Can you imagine? The absolute shitstorm that would happen after that. It'd be great.
Mind you, if you said define safety too, you might get some freaking common sense answers. We might all know what it's all about by the end of it.
Oh, love it. But that is the thing is, I was talking to Sam last night. He was like, let's just do it. Let's just do it. And I was like, Sam, I think it's a good idea. I am concerned about my health. Like getting absolutely sloshed one day a month. I'm not sure I'm up for that. I'm 30 this year, mate. And he's like, I'm 32. I can't remember what he said, but and I was just like, dude, I don't think we can hack it. I'll be hungover till like the following month where we do the next.
Tell me about it, mate. Tell me about it. My other half bought me a bottle. Well, in fact, he bought me 2 bottles of champagne yesterday and a glass in last night. And I was like, zonked on the sofa. Oh my God, this is so embarrassing. So yeah, and it doesn't take me much to get absolutely leathered anyway, to be honest with you. So I wouldn't be much of a guest on that one. I'd probably be asleep after 10 minutes. Get some good snoring sound bites though.
Well, I think that's it. I think you're on the panel, Trader.
Yeah, that's
decided.
I'm
right.
In.
Let's talk about something sensible. Why don't you give us an introduction into yourself first? Like how where did you get? Like, were you a normal safety professional before you went into?
I was never normal. Never normal. No. I was. I grew up in power distribution, high voltage power distribution. I started many years ago. Too many years ago. on a site office, actually, for what was then Balfour Kilpatrick in my home city of Plymouth. They were putting a 132 kV cable through, and they were looking for a temporary site office clerk. And and I went in and applied for the job and got it. And then about 6 months into the job, the managing director for the local construction office came down to visit me, and he said, "Have you heard of this thing called BS5750? And I was like, "No." And he said, "Well, basically what it is, it's about being able to file stuff really neatly." And, you know, and I really like the way you do our files here, and I think you'd be really good at it. Do you want to be the quality assurance manager for Wales in the West Country? And I've always been a person, and my team will tell you this, I've always been a bit like the old Catherine Tate character. I can do that.
I can do that.
I've always been like that. I can do that. So I was like, yeah, I can do that. So that's what I did. I went off, he sent me off to Bournemouth on a 3-day lead auditors course. Right. And then I moved up to Cardiff and started to work for them up there. And kind of that was it. But it was such a great organization in those days to work for.
Yeah.
That you just got the opportunity to try anything and everything. So in a very short space of time, I went from being a site office clerk. During the time that I was on the job in Plymouth, I ended up doing a lot of the drawing because I had an O level in technical drawing. Make sure you.
Do you want me to replace O with A on that? Just so that people.
No, it's no. Fine. And it was like, have you got an O level in technical drawing? Yeah. Oh, great. Our draftsman's gone sick. Do you want to do the Aslay drawings for this 132 kV cable?
I can do that.
Yeah, I can do that. so that was it, basically. And then, as I said, I moved up to Cardiff, and then very quickly, really just, you know, working with amazing people. And that's the bottom line of it, working with amazing foremen, supervisors, engineers, you know, and managers who just let me learn my craft, whatever my craft was. Mm. And I ended up becoming sort of getting involved in project management, little toe in the water with health and safety, but not too much.
Yeah.
And then basically they won a job on the railways, and it was a points heating job. And they were like, we've never worked on the railways before. Mm-hmm. And we need to learn how to do that. I was like, I can do that. So that was how I got involved in, you know, the first job on the railways many years ago was installing points heating. And then just became like everyone does, I think. You just get bitten by the bug on the railways. And that's where I then stayed for 17 years in a whole variety of operational roles, you know. And then, unfortunately, you know, I kind of learned my craft that way. I didn't go to university or go to college. I didn't, you know, get qualifications at that point to do that job. I was just a bit of a jack of all trades, to be honest with you. But I, you know, I worked my ass off and worked hard and put 110% into everything. And I wanted to try everything, and, you know. Mm. So, unfortunately, I was running a job on the railways, and there was an accident, a road traffic accident, in which 7 of my guys were killed.
Wow.
And it was career changing, and it was life changing for me, to be honest with you. Yeah. And I'd sort of grown up being one of these project managers or operational managers, if you like. That was I hated the health and safety people. It's like they were the biggest pain in the ass ever, you know. You know, just tick the box, fill in the sheet. Oh God, they're coming tomorrow to do an inspection. Make sure everything's right. Make sure everyone's got their high vis on. Yeah, absolutely. Get your eye vis on. Make sure you got your gloves and all the, you know, all that. And it was like that. And when I look back now, I think, did I know any different? No, I didn't. That's how I'd been trained. You know, it was budget. It was, you know, program and, you know, making as much money as we could and getting the job done to the quality and all that good stuff. Anyway, this accident happened. And it really rocked me, because I think for the first time ever, suddenly this thing called health and safety was very serious. It was in sharp contrast. Mm. And I really, at that point in time, leaned heavily on the people around me that were qualified in this stuff, you know. I was frightened. I was frightened for me. I was frightened for my career. That's the truth. But more importantly, you know, there were seven families and that were torn apart, and it was just shocking. So I basically made a decision that I didn't ever want to manage anyone ever again. That was it. I was done. Yeah. But what I did want to do was I really wanted to understand what made these people tick, you know. And there was some information coming out of the accident, and that made me start to ask questions about myself as a leader on that job. And you know, why did the guys do what they did? Why did they were drunk? Why did they get in a van drunk? Why did they think it was so important to get to the job that day? There were lots and lots of circumstances. If you were writing a case study now for human performance, this, you know, you couldn't write a better one. So I went on a bit of a journey of discovery and got the opportunity to go back, well, to go to university and do my degree in occupational safety and health. And started to look at, though, in those days, what was new was behavior-based safety. So everyone was doing, you know, DuPont stuff and Safe Start and all this, you know, great BST was another company that were around at the time. And I went into this wholeheartedly. I just embraced it. I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, because it was about helping the guys and girls. There weren't many guys around in those days in the industry. There weren't many girls around those days, I have to say. But, you know, helping the guys to get rid of that sort of ego and be able to look out for each other, brother's keeper, and all that good stuff that you know of. And I just thought it was, I thought it was phenomenal. I loved it.
And it probably was at the time, was it? Oh, it was, like BBS was the best thing since sliced bread.
It really was, because, you know, we'd had, you know, when you think about it, we'd had compliance-based safety, because the Health and Safety at Work Act came in and the regs came in, or there was six pack in the olden in the good old days, and then all the regs started to come in. Then I think we got into process safety, where we started to understand more about, you know, loss of containment and this kind of thing, and then we moved into behavior-based safety, and it seemed like the logical next step. You know, we've got our house in order. We've got a standard. Now we've got our house in order. Now we understand the hazards that we introduce to the workplace, and now we've got to get the people sorted. And so it made complete logical sense, and I loved it. So that was really at the time when I got into safety, you know, properly, and I was about 18 months in, and at this point in time, I'd gone to work at two coal-fired power stations, and I'd gone there specifically really to bring in this behaviour-based safety. And we were sort of 18 months in, and I was sitting there with a pile of, our behaviour-based safety program was something we developed with the guys on the two power stations. It was called SABRE, Safe Behaviour Recognition Program. And it was phenomenal. The guys themselves developed it. They were passionate about it. And, you know, we were getting thousands and thousands of these observation cards coming in. And it was a fantastic program. But 18 months in, there was quite a bad accident on site. And what I learned was that we had this ton of observation cards that were largely telling us that we were pretty shit at housekeeping, and that, you know, people didn't like wearing PPE. And, you know, we'd made a commitment to investigate every single thing that goes wrong on our site, and we were running around chasing our tails, you know, focusing on the wrong things. And unfortunately, we had a Dazir incident in a mill, and some guys got, you know, really badly burned.
That must have been like mind blowing to a point that you probably thought you had it with the behavioral based safety stuff. Yeah, like what a way to kind of, I can't imagine, Teresa, what that phone call or however you found out was like, because you must have been like, shit, I thought we had this. I really thought we had this.
We did. I mean, I wasn't on my own. Obviously, there was a team of us, and you know, we worked so hard on this program, and we had driven down. We'd seen that, you know, predicted up the number of near hits going up, but the incidents coming down. It was looking as predicted. what we expected to happen was what was happening. And then suddenly this happens. And then after that, there were some more serious incidents and more serious incidents. And I kind of got disheartened with it a little bit and started to think, well, you know, what else is there? This isn't it. And I think people just, you know, I got to the point where I was sick of, you know, having a numbers meeting. Well, you haven't filled in your four bloody near hits this month, or you haven't done, you know, we didn't hit 600 Sabre observations this month. And it was like, this is just crazy. It's crazy. And we'd lost the management. You know, I think management tend to engage with the safety program for 18 months if you're lucky, and then they've moved on and they're looking for the next, you know, one hit wonder. And I was really frustrated. At the time, I was working, as I said, at the power stations, and I got the opportunity to go on a training course, this thing called Human Performance, HPI, Human Performance Improvement, which had been in the nuclear part of that business for a number of years, since, you know, sort of the late 90s, early 2000s. And I went on a four-day course with Shane Bush, who was doing all the training. And I trained as a HOP or HPI practitioner. This course, day one, I was like, I don't understand it. I really thought this is rubbish. By the end of day two, I was a disciple. Honestly, it was that powerful. Wow. And it was suddenly like all of the gaps, you know, all of the pennies started to drop, all the gaps started to get filled. And I was like, this is the game changer. This is the thing. It's not about, you know, getting the guys to follow the procedure, you know, shop each other when they see each other doing something unsafe, or, you know, take responsibility. You know, it's my responsibility if you're not wearing your PPE. No, it's not. You know, actually, it's about what is driving your behavior or my behavior when we're set to work. And, you know, as simple as it sounds all these years later to me, it was a complete game changer. And, you know, suddenly I went back into my workplace thinking I can make a difference. I can make a massive difference just with this little bit of knowledge. And the fact that actually it wasn't us as a management team or as a health and safety team who were creating safety with our so-called wonderful procedures. It was the guys creating safety despite of our crappy procedures. And it was like, whoa, this, you know, so it was just a game changer for me. And I got passionate about it. And I took the manuals, the Department of Energy manuals, as they were, and they still are. I mean, they're still like the Bible for HOP practitioners today, I think. And I devoured them. And I went back to my power stations and I just turned this theory into real tangible tools and techniques, and worked with the guys at the power stations and implemented this program. And then I got invited to go out to Canada and do some work with OPG. I got invited to go and spend a couple of weeks with the regulator, Tanya Hewitt and team, and when she was at the regulator there. And I just embraced this fully. And I eventually got promoted to go into the nuclear side of the business. So I was looking after human performance and nuclear professionalism. Wow. And I spent 3 or 4 years there doing that, and really honing my craft and my skill and really studying up on this. But as with most, you know, sort of jobs, let's just say, I felt confined by what I could achieve there. You know, nuclear is a hard industry to work in. It's a hard industry to go in if you've not grown up in the nuclear industry. You know, and people would look at, oh, you've come from a coal-fired power station. Oh, and before that, you're on the railways. All right, yeah, great. What do you know about nuclear? That, you know, so it was hard to make the scale of change that I knew human performance could bring. And, you know, long story short, an opportunity came for me to part ways. And with many, many conversations over the internet and things with Shane and his wife, Peggy, who were like, you should just do this yourself, you know. by then causes started coming in. Can you help us with this? Could we have this off you? You know, and that kind of thing. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to take the next opportunity that comes along. I'm going to do this. And I think the driver behind it, and the driver behind it, even now today, 3.5 years in, is nobody should get killed at work. Nobody should be killed at work. And nobody should be killed driving to work or driving home from work. You know, and people shouldn't feel so desperate to get to work that they'll take massive risks like getting a van drunk and, you know, things like that. And as leaders, one of the things I say a lot is, and it's not my saying, I did pinch it from someone else, but it's as leaders, we have to be mindful of the shadow we cast. And it's broad and it's deep. And the things that we say as leaders have less impact than the things that we do. You know, so if we say, oh yeah, we want this job done, it's got to, you know, we've got to get this operating unit back on at a power station and it's got to be back on for Monday morning, but you know, and we'll get it done safely. It doesn't happen. The unit goes back on, but nobody goes back and asks the question about how did we do it, you know? And so there's a couple of things really that really drive me today. And that is trying to make Paradigm into an organization through collaboration, because we can't do it on our own. Hence our webinars. We're creating this, you know, community of practice, and I'm learning from the Joe Estes and the Todd Conklins, and I'm like a sponge. I soak all of this stuff up and I love it. So to turn Paradigm into a real force that can turn workplaces into healthy, safer environments where people are respected for their knowledge and their expertise, and they're listened to.
Yeah, I love
because that's all human performance is. It's just listening to people and respecting what they know about their job and taking that and learning from it. The other thing is never ever, if it's within my gift, to let another manager go through that pain of feeling responsible when somebody dies under your watch or on your watch. And that will live with me for the rest of my life. And it's what gets me out of bed every morning. If a client rings and says, we've had an incident, my heart comes up into my mouth. That's the first thing. I want to know if everyone's all right. I want to know if the management are all right. And if it's a health and safety manager I'm speaking to, and it very often is, and they've rung and said, Therese, can you come and help? I just want to support them and, you know, say, are you okay? What do you need from me right now? You know? And it's the most horrible thing in the world. And if we're going to go through that as leaders, and we are, because we will continue to hurt people at work, unfortunately, then I want to be there to support as many of them as I can. And when it can't be me, then I want to create this community where we're all together, you know, no matter which one of us is going through this, we can pick up the phone to any one of the others and say, this is a shit day at the office and I need some help, you know, because there's no worse place to be. There's no worse place to be. So, yeah, that's what
story.
I never ever thought, you know, 20 years ago that I'd be here doing this job today. I never thought I'd run my own business. I didn't think I'd, you know, have the nerve to do that. And it's hard. It's hard. And this year, Jesus, it's pretty shit actually this year. This year's been hell. But this year, I think our job is more important than any other year, actually, ironically, because companies are expecting a lot of their people this year. And at some point, something has to give. And I don't know about you in your practice, but I'm just seeing people at the moment, they just look so tired.
I think almost it's
broken.
I think it's in a way, I'm kind of so thankful to be going through coronavirus, because I don't think there's ever been a lesson for safety professionals, human performance, whatever you want to call yourself. I don't think there's ever been a lesson from it. And also, like, I cannot wait to, in a year, 2 years time, when all this, like, all the academic sociologists and psychologists and economists, there we go, are all doing their research right now. And they're all working out, watching us, and they're all going, oh, and we're going to, hopefully, you know, if we've taken this opportunity, we're going to have so much data, so much qualitative and hopefully quantitative or whatever we want to look at, so much information and data to inform how we work going forward. But we kind of have to go through this. And my concern is that we don't learn the right lessons. I think we'll learn a lesson, but it is whether it's the right one. And I'm hearing some conversations of people going, do you know what, I've got less people at work and we're banging out more products, or we're more efficient, we're so much quicker. And I'm like, whoa, calm down a second, let's just that's fair enough, because in this time your staff, if you've got that right kind of culture, you know, they've come into this environment, they've realized I'm grateful to have my job, I'm grateful to still be working, I feel safe, whatever, and I'm just going to plow, we need to get this job done and we need to get through this, that's really, really good. Kind of they're, you know, you've hopefully, if you've been able to be profitable through this process, you're quite a resilient business, but that doesn't mean that is the permanent state forever, because if you did that, ironically, you wouldn't be that resilient in a year's time, you would eventually just snap.
It's like an elastic band, and it's only got so much stretch. And that's what resiliency is all about, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. And I just think we call it, obviously, you know, I'm teaching you, preaching to the choir, but this normalization of deviance, you know, because that's the problem. That's what we can do very quickly. This becomes the way we do things around here, but it's not. It's not the way we do things around here. So, it's a big worry that, and already, like I said, I'm seeing some of that. I'm seeing incidents start to creep up. I'm seeing the severity of incidents creep up. Yeah. And I think people are tired. Mm. I think I did a panel discussion the other day for Paul Clark's HSE Congress. Yeah. And Anna Keane was on it. And she said, she's always profound, the things that she says, but she said, in the next 10, 15 years, no one will ever write their CV without putting what they did during COVID on it, so it will change our profession. But really what, this thing about how leadership will look different as we go forward from here, and I don't think that the skills and the attitudes and the things that we celebrated in leaders pre-COVID will be the same as we celebrate in the future. That vulnerability, it will be so important to us. And those are the people who have led best. I mean, the CEO of BP, you just got to follow him on LinkedIn and see some of the stuff that he's been doing, during the pandemic, and just laying his soul bare, really, and other amazing leaders out there who are just doing things so differently and really shaking things up out there. Those are the people that we need to look up to, I think, and follow their lead. But yeah, you're right. This has been a massive learning curve, and there is so much to take away from it. And hopefully we haven't all been too sort of head down, ass up in the muck and bullets to recognize that the majority of those organizations out there have done a bloody good job getting through this, and but I think the face of leadership will definitely change. So
and I just hope people come out of it grateful for their people. Do you know what I mean? Like there ain't no one got you through this other than the people that are down in the dirt, running the machines or building the house or whatever. I really, really hope that not just in a business aspect, but also in like a social aspect, where those people that some people may have looked down upon, like cleaners or carers. You know, my family's full of carers, and my wife, you know, has been a carer. She's on maternity leave right now, but you know, she's a carer. My mum's a carer. You know, both work in hospitals, and even I, you know, back at years and years and years ago, was born and raised to kind of look down on those kind of roles. I never looked down on the person, but it was always like I never wanted to be in that role. And that, and now I look back on it and I go, Jesus Christ, if we didn't have those roles, that, can you imagine if we didn't have cleaners, if we didn't have carers, if we didn't have nurses, you know? And I think nurses and doctors kind of demand a bit more respect, but it's those roles that we forget about. The corner shops, you know, the Tesco shelf stackers and people like that, that Jesus Christ have had the biggest challenge of their life. And now we look at it and I'm just so grateful to those people. And I hope that businesses appreciate that. And I hope that, that societies appreciate that now, you know. Granted, there's a bigger economical kind of conversation around it, but you know, we maybe even paying these people more or you know, something around that. Are we like, we're paying the wrong people? I was listening to a podcast this morning, Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat podcast, and they had a gentleman on who I can't for the life of me remember his name, but he was talking about bureaucracy, like beating bureaucracy. And he said that, that I think it was 20% of a business is pure bureaucracy, like the middle management and admin teams that, that just get paid a hell of a lot of money but deliver very little value to the business. And actually you could save a hell of a lot of money by getting rid of that section of your business and taking that money and putting it to where it matters, which is exactly what we talk about in safety and in human performance and safety too. Where it matters is the shop floor.
I mean, look at, you know, when you think about it, just picking up on what you said about, you know, our cleaners and our carers and, you know, bus drivers, all of those people who have continued to work through this. I mean, when you talk about high hazard industries, you know, pre-COVID, you'd think oil and gas, you think power, you think, you know, all of those, you know, high hazard industry this year, working at Tesco's, working in a care home. You know, and those people, they have to have nerves of steel to get out of bed every morning and go and do that job. Like you, my mum, you know, worked in nursing homes when I was a kid, and so yeah, absolutely, maximum respect to those people. But working in them during this time, where they can't even go and see their own families, you know, because they're putting their jobs first. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But that's the whole thing for me. Everyone who's going out there and they're working for the man, they deserve that respect. And that's the whole thing, I think, with, you know, that. And it really does. I mean, I don't want to get into the sort of the argument of it, but I guess it's worth touching on it. What has really shocked me of our community, if you like, our health and safety community, is with all this crap. Good.
Here we go.
No. Is with all of this crap going on, all of this COVID going on, you've still got them battling about, is it safety differently? Is it safety two? Is it safety one? Is it safety three?
And it's both
three?
Sides. It's both
is,
sides.
Oh, it totally is.
Of the and fence. It's like,
who gives a shit?
To be
perfectly frank. Do you know what? It's about the people who are out there and making sure that they can go home from work at the end of their shift with 10 fingers, 10 toes, and that we're not hurting them. We're not hurting our business anymore, and we're not hurting the environment. I don't give a toss whether you proceduralize it, whether you rely on it, whatever it is. It's a journey. It's a maturity journey. It's not one or the other. And you know, for me, I think that as a community on LinkedIn, particularly, which is where we all see it all, there's so much BS going on at the moment. It's like, you know, and unfortunately, really good people are tied up in this political, you know, debate. When they should actually be getting off their asses, going out there and working with these organisations who are losing people, and you know, and like I say, who have suddenly become high hazard industries. You know, instead of worrying about is it safety one, is it safety two, get out there and make a bloody difference and keep some people safe. So for me, it's like, you know, I think as a community, we're missing the bloody trick.
Yeah.
We've got a big job to do at the moment, a big job to do in helping these organizations. And, you know, when one of the biggest things I get asked by, you know, clients when I go and work with health and safety teams, they say, you know, we love this HOP stuff. We love human performance. We like the sound of safety differently, but we can't get buy-in from our leaders. You know, we just can't get them to engage with us and they don't want to hear us. And I'm like, have you got an idea of what they're dealing with at the moment? Yeah. Because while we're over here in our little bubble, playing like kids in a bloody playground, our business leaders are over here trying to survive.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're losing the plot a little bit as a community at the moment, and it needs a rocket.
I love that. I was talking to my friend last night who's not a safety professional, he's a builder, a house builder, and we were talking about our profession, and he's saying, you know, the world, this is the first time in my career, at least, this is the first time that we are seen now, where depending on the culture in your business, this is the first time you are looked upon as an asset. Because it was a safety professional that gets you back to work. You know, everyone was locked down, and then we were unlocked down, and now it's like, you need to make us COVID secure. However you did that, I don't give a shit. Whether you did procedures, whether you forced it on everybody or you engaged them, I really don't care. But the point is that the world is now looking at the safety professional, right? This is your time to not be a dickhead. It's kind of what we were talking about last night. This is the time not to go, do you know what? I've been trying to get this new version of a checklist and I'm going to absolutely go nuts and I'm going to ask for loads of funding. No. This is the time to go to your leaders and say, what can I do? Yeah. And this is the time to go to the shop floor and go, what can I do? And that's it. This is not the time to pull out all those old projects that got turned down because you didn't have the budget, because everyone's listening to you now. This is the time to kind of relax. You've done your job. You've got everybody back to work. Now you're dealing with a local lockdown, whatever. Deal with COVID. Prove your worth in that, because that's where people are looking. And then the rest of your time, build relationships.
Yeah, totally.
Like, as far as I'm concerned, don't think that this is everyone's looking at us now, so let's go safety mad. No. Just calm down a little bit. Bide your time and pick your battles. Because I'm so scared now of us all just going nuts and be like, now's the time, no matter what side of the defense you're on, now's the time to implement a HOP scheme in our business. You know, let's get loads of funding. Do you know what I mean? Like, no, people, they don't give a shit about that. They haven't got time right now. They're trying to work out how we don't make people redundant next year and how we have to pay the bills.
You're absolutely spot on.
And to your point about the bickering, I think we'll wait till the end of this episode and we'll see where the conversation goes. But I think if it carries on down this route, I will add this to the mini series that's going to come out, that now it comes out on Monday. But it's Safety 1 and Safety 2. That's what the mini series is called.
Yeah.
And it's called that for a reason, because it's my learning journey, essentially, talking to people like Todd Conklin, John Green, Kelvin Genn, and then Adam Johns, Kevin Furness, who else have we got? Carsten Busch, David Provan.
Yeah.
I think we're doing some republish of a conversation I had with Ron Gant a long time ago. But the point Ron's is, great. It's me learning about what is Safety 1, what is Safety 2. But I'm also trying to say, if I don't really care what happens, whichever one works for you, pick it. It's like people ask me, well, what are you, Safety 1, Safety 2? I'm like, do you know what I am? I'm a bloke at a buffet. And there's loads of stuff, and I'm going to take a pick of what works. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not going to go up and just be like, I only like sausage rolls, so I'm going to take some sausage rolls and that's it. Just have a whole plate of sausage rolls. How boring. I'm going to be like, I'm a little sausage roll. I'm going to have a little samosa over here. And then I'm running out of what's on the buffet. pineapple and cheese. Peach, yeah. But like that's how I look at this. Like, I take a little bit of human performance, but I'm not going to like, it'd be interesting to see actually how you kind of do this in with your clients. But like, when we want to move into this world of safety two, it's that old argument, isn't it, of like, we're going to destroy safety one. And it's like, safety one's kind of the foundations of what we need to build on. So how does that look like for you when you go into a client? When you say you've got, say I'm your client, I ring you up and I go, Teresa, I've been doing this real process-based safety for ages. It's compliance, compliance, compliance. I finally got leaders on board. They're listening to me. They think safety two or HOP is the way to go. Like, what does that look like, that process? How do you kind of approach that?
Well, the first thing is that I want to confirm that they are legally compliant. I want to know that for definite, because unfortunately, there are companies who will ring us up and say, yep, it's, you know, it, we want this HOP stuff because they perceive it's about fixing their workers. It's the next thing to fix the workers.
That's interesting.
And then very often we'll go in and we'll start to talk to them. Our first point is to talk about organizational drift and help them to understand how, you know, they're achieving their successful outcomes because of the things that their people are doing, whether that be following procedures or not following procedures. Mm. So the way that that company is setting its people up is the most important thing. So first thing I want to know is, are you legally compliant? Because I don't want to come and spend a lot of your time, money and effort looking at, maturing your safety culture and those kind of things, and looking at those behaviors and leadership skills if you haven't got a COSH procedure, or your guys are working at height and they're not clipped on, you've creating explosive atmospheres, or unfortunately many of the organizations, they're not compliant. It's not good enough.
Jesus Christ. Sorry, I think my wife's home. Either that or someone's at the door. Give me 1 second, just check what's going on.
No worries.
I tell you what it was, a fat load of nothing, literally nothing at my door.
Well, that's the best thing to have disturb you on a Saturday night, mate.
What an absolute dickhead of a dog. He's so loud.
Well, mine's deaf, so, and he's got kidney, he's very old, he's 16, he's a West Island Terrier, and all he does pretty much is snore and sleep. That's about it, you know, a snore and eat, that's about it. So yeah, I want to know if they're compliant, and because if they're not, that's where their focus needs to be. And it's really easy to go in and do all the sexy stuff and all the, you know, all the soft, fluffy, nice stuff. But if while I'm in there doing that, the HSE come in and they've got a breach of a regulation, then it makes me look pretty bloody stupid, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I need to know that what we've now come to call Safety One, is that there? Are they as good as they need to be? And are they compliant with the law? And are they creating safe work environments for their people? Are they setting them to work safely? So things like that, you know, and I really do want to look at those hard and fast things first. So, you know, typically we would go in and, you know, I mean, we offer a service in that, you know, we help companies get compliant first and foremost. Okay. It's important. Yeah. Then we're at, where I really want to look, and this is something that I guess, you know, from Todd, because we all learn from Todd, and it's, how do you respond to failure? That's a big question for me. So the next point for me very often is, let me have a look at some of the incidents that have happened in the past. Let me look at how you've investigated them. Let me look at what you've found as the causal factors, what things led to those incidents. And what did you do once you found those things to try and prevent that happening again? You know, old style safety one, root cause analysis. I'm sorry, I don't think it'll ever go away. Yeah. I think we have to analyze incidents and understand why they occurred. I can't think of any other way we would ever do that. So I want to understand that, because then I start to understand the culture of the organization. So are they, you know, is it a blame culture? Is it a no blame culture? Is it a fair blame culture? Whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So I want to understand that, because then at that point I need to understand, you know, if an incident occurs in this organization, and I'm likely, or I'm going to be helping somebody to investigate the thing that's gone wrong, what I want to understand is, if that person straight away that they're involved in an incident is under an HR process, a disciplinary process, then I probably can't interview them and get a really good safety interview out of them. Does that make sense when I say safety interview, you know? Because they're going to be fearful for their job because they're under this HR process. So I don't always see my job as just working with a health and safety manager or a health and safety team. And so typically when we go to work with an organization, I want to speak to the CEO, I want to speak to the COO, I want to speak to the operations directors, because I want to know how they set their people up for success and what they understand about their legal responsibilities under the Health and Safety at Work Act, but other, you know, and where the health and safety teams sit in their estimation. So that's kind of, you know, for me, the building blocks are the first thing that I want to check on. Then I want to understand the culture, because one thing I will never, ever do, and we don't do this as Paradigm, is there's no manual that we take off the shelf here and go, all right, here you go. It, you know, follow that from A to Z and you'll be perfect. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. We want to work with our client. We want to work with our client. We want to understand their culture. We want to understand their leadership culture. And then we want to give them the best chance of success with their program. So there's no point going into a really, you know, I mean, you mentioned the word bureaucracy, and I'm a great person for like playing on words. Bureaucracy isn't a bad thing. You know, it's not an evil thing. Bureaucracy is good when it's there for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Red tape is not good. Lots and lots of red tape. But bureaucracy is a good thing. It's meant, you know, accountability is a good thing. Discipline is a bloody good thing. We all need that in our organizations. But very often we can get too hung up on words and suddenly they have a bad connotation. So, you know, accountability and responsibility and blame, you know, these three words for me get interchanged. You know, they get lots in organizations, you know, but we don't use the word accountability because, you know, that used to be a really bad word for the old CEO. So now we use responsibility. It's the same bloody word, you know, it's got the same meaning. For you, it's got the same meaning. But, you know, get a dictionary. And these are not bad words, they're just words. So understanding that before you can even start to think about, you know, how is this organization going to shift from its current paradigm to where we would like it to be. So compliance, behaviors of workers and managers and leaders, and then looking at how do we set our people up and how do we drive the behaviors that we're looking for. And the other thing as well, which is really interesting for me, is when we talk about culture, you know, and people say, well, you know, what is the culture of this organization? It's just the world according to Teresa. But I think as a leadership team, you have to determine what the culture of your organization is that you want. Otherwise, you're just going to get led by the nose. Because no matter what you want, you will have a culture. As a leadership team, you have the opportunity to determine what that culture is and then move your organization in that direction. Or you just, like I say, you just get led around by the nose. And so when I go and work with management teams and leadership teams, I say to them, what's the culture of your organization? And they say, well, yes, it's this, it's that. And I say, so, you know, what is the culture that you're looking for? Well,
wow.
and it's like, it's like I've just come from a different planet. You know, it's like, well, what do you mean? What's the culture we want? Well, it's your destiny. You need to decide what kind of company you want to run.
Yeah.
And then what we can do is we can help you put the things in place that can move you in that direction. But you know what? You're going to have to live and breathe and eat and sleep it every day for the next God knows how many years until it happens. And the minute you slip off course, guess what? All your people are going to follow you off course as well. So I think, you know, all of those things, and it's really difficult to say, well, right, we don't go into a company and go A, B, C, D, and E, and then we're out of there and they're all great and sparkly and shiny. It doesn't work like that. The one thing that Paradigm does, which I think differentiates us, and again, me determining the culture of the organization I wanted to run 3.5 years ago when I set this up, I'd worked in corporate and I'd brought consultants in. Mm. And typically they were a pain in the ass. They really were. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd come in, they'd be on a day rate, I'd give them a desk in the office, and 3 years later they'd still be sitting there, you know. I don't know whether I've just lost you. Are you okay?
I can still see
you. You know, 3 years later they'd still be sitting there polishing a seat with their ass in my office, you know, and I'd be thinking, you know, when do they leave? Yeah. And if they leave, does all the work that they've just done go with them? So I didn't want to be that kind of consultancy organization. And I also knew that I didn't want to be just a training company, because just training delivers nothing. Yeah. You know, I can put 300 people through a training course tomorrow. In a year's time, I will have nothing to show for my money.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I knew I didn't want to be a crap consultancy, and I knew I didn't want to run a training company. So therefore, our business model was built around that. And our business model is, we go in, we understand you where you are today. We build on what is good in your organization, and there will be good things, even if they're not quite ticking properly at the moment. They might just need a bit of tuning or a fine adjustment, but there will be good things that we can build on. And then I want to identify with you the people in your organization that can work alongside me and my team and learn to do what we do. So very quickly, our sort of model becomes, we come in, we build alongside you, we build your internal capability, we watch and we supervise and we mentor and we coach. And then when the stabilizers are off, you know, we step back and you know, your program is sustainable without us, because I've got another, you know, my goal for my organization, my first goal was, educate 1,000 organizations by 2030. And that was about where we spoke, who we spoke to, what we gave away, what we did for free, which in the first year was most stuff. We just did it for free. And then within 18 months, we had 1,000 organizations on our list. And it was like, well, we've done that. Yeah. So now it's 30,000 organizations by 2030.
Nice.
And I can't do that on my own. So that's why, you know, we work with you, and, you know, we work with Joe Esty and Todd Conklin and Shane Bush, and the webinar, you know, which regularly has 70, 80 people a week on it, because that's how we will create this community and drive this movement, you know. And the other thing, you know, for me about business is there is so much for us all to do.
Yeah.
There is so much work out there. We don't need to fight each other for work.
Yeah.
So I don't consider myself to have any competitors. I don't have any competitors. All I have are collaborators. And if a client rings me up and says, I need 20 consultants all around the world next week, guess what? I've got about 60 companies that I can pick up the phone to tonight, and they'll say, yep, Therese, how many people do you want and where do you want them?
Yeah.
And so that's the business that I'm building. And it really is, we stay true to that culture that we're creating, which is a collaborative culture. It's about giving back more than we take, you know, and like I said right at the start, really, just making work a healthier, safer, more respectful environment for everyone. And yeah, there are countries where we've got a lot of work to do. There are companies where we've got a lot of work to do. But there's enough of us. If we just work together and we stop bickering and we stop saying, is it one? Is it two? Now, is it bloody three? For God's sake, as if we weren't confused enough.
Yeah.
It's just all of us, and we're on a mission, and we need to get our act together and work together to change it.
Oh, hear, hear. 100%. I'm going to cut that. And that's going to be a clip, 100%. That was great. Well said, Theresa. I mean, there's so much there that you've said that I just, as you're kind of talking, I'm like, oh, that's a good conversation point. I'll put that there. And there's another one thing, I'll put that there. Oh, there's another one, bing, 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 bing. And now I'm like, oh, too much. I love the way you kind of, the way you talk about in the work, that's just so much, like, you know, are you compliant? It's like that is, I hate the word compliance, because And this is interesting because this will bring us on to the piece you said about words that we use. I hate the word compliance, but I don't hate the word compliance. I hate the way we use the word compliance.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is interesting. And it's interesting that you said that's exactly what you said. And it's interesting when I, and the episode coming out on Monday, me, and if you'd listened to Todd's podcast, you probably heard it, but Todd was actually on my podcast when he put out on his, was ages ago. Well, the full one's coming out on mine on Monday. And we kind of got, we didn't get going, but we kind of had a misunderstanding of each other between the word I use as efficiency. He asked me to define safety. And I said, well, I define safety as efficiency because I've always been taught that you kind of, you design safety in. And when I look at efficiency, for me, it's inefficient to lose lives at work. It's inefficient to have accidents at work because that costs money, costs time, et cetera, et cetera, yeah. Which is in effect is inefficient in my opinion. And I understood where he was coming from. You know, he basically talking about the Eric Honnagle's thoroughness and efficiency trade-off and, yeah, I get where he's going. But the examples that I thought he used on efficiency, to my opinion, was over-efficiency. Like driving, a car for 100 years, 100 miles an hour, because that's the fastest it could go, for example, and never MOTing it and never servicing it is what some people call efficient. I don't think that's efficient. I think that's inefficient. So yeah. It's really fascinating what you say.
But it's effective.
Yeah.
And that's the other word, isn't it? Efficiency versus effectiveness as well.
And we can go on forever, I think, just arguing about these words all the time. And I just think, Joe, what does it mean for you? Like if I go into a business and they were like, right, we want to be compliant. I'm okay. What's compliant?
Yeah.
What's compliant for you? If they turn around and say, you know, I want to write 100 procedures and I want all of my people to be exactly doing that. Okay. What's that procedure look like? Because some people will think that a procedure is step one, step two, step three, left foot, right foot, right foot. But they might call it a procedure, but actually that procedure is quite descriptive and not prescriptive. It's just a word that they use. And it's, I've gone through that myself, like I'm still going through that now, that battle of just going, oh, if you say you're a consultant and or you manage compliance, I'll write you off straight away. It wasn't so long ago I wrote on this podcast said I don't apply for a job if it says compliance in the title. I won't apply for it. Now I probably still wouldn't, but my point is that I judge a lot of people and a lot of things on that word compliance or words like procedure, but actually it exists for a reason. Like you do have to be compliant with the law.
Yeah. It's, you know, well, that's, you know, at the end of the day, it is a health and safety manager as a senior manager, believe you me, on that day in court, compliant is your favorite bloody word.
You're hoping someone calls you compliant.
Absolutely. So you better bloody know if you're compliant or not. So, true. You know, for me, as I say, they are just words. I think the Health and Safety at Work Act is there for a reason. The Factories Act before it, these things are there for a reason and we can't ignore them. And, you know, we have to do, you know, what we can. I think we get tied up in knots, and we don't understand ALARP. We don't understand as low as reasonably practicable. There's lots of stuff that we don't understand and we don't do very well, I think. You know, tolerable risk. Well, what's a tolerable risk? Well, nothing's tolerable. Well, then we're into the whole bloody zero harm conversation. Let's not go there. But what we have to do, it's our job, it's our responsibility as a health and safety community to help the managers and the people that we support and keep out of prison understand their responsibility. And it's our responsibility to make sure that they know what they have to do in order to make their people safe and make their company safe and so on and so forth. Their focus is making profit. And I know that we talk about, you know, well, profit versus safety and all the rest of it. If we don't make a profit, we might as well not bother going to work.
Yes.
You know? And, yes. if safety really is your overriding, you know, it's the number one thing, well, tell everyone to stay at home, shut the gates and don't bother operating.
There's only one company in the UK that should have safety first as their priority. That's the HSE, as far as I'm concerned. That is it. Everyone else makes a profit. If you don't make a profit, I ain't got a job. Like, I can't go into the boardroom and say, you must put safety first, because I hope they don't. Because if they put safety first, I'm screwed. Like, I'm out of the job.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I've got some bills to pay.
Yeah, exactly. But unfortunately, you know, where, because sometimes, and again, you know, I don't think the way that we're, you know, our Anna, have you interviewed Anna yet on this?
I actually haven't. No, I've spoken to Anna so many times, but Anna, sorry.
Oh, you've got to get her on here, because, you know, she'll be able to talk with much more authority about the way we're trained as a profession and the way we're taught and what we're taught. You know, we're taught compliance, we're taught about the regulations, and we're taught case study and all of that great stuff. And it is great stuff. And as I've already said, we need it. You know, jobs are good. But what we also need is a seat at the top table. I love it when I go to an organization and I'm talking to a health and safety director, VP, whatever it is, and who do you report to? I report to the CEO, or I report to the board.
Definitely.
Fantastic. Normally, we're on a winner. Because safety has got a voice at the top table, and it is important, and it is recognized, and it is valued. When I go to organizations, and it's not all of them, when I go to an organization, I say to the health and safety person, who do you report to? And it's, well, I report into the HR manager, I report into, you know, the finance manager, the operations manager, which is a bit like, you know, the fox watching the chickens sometimes, not always, but it can be.
Conflict of interest, as far as I'm concerned.
Conflict of priorities, you know, and also very often reporting into somebody who doesn't know my profession. Yeah. So if I'm reporting into an operations director who's got, you know, quality, who's got finance, who's got, you know, operations, engineering, all of these other responsibilities, safety just becomes a noise amongst many other things. And if there's something else that's his priority for that week, then safety can drop down the priorities. And unfortunately,
I was going to say,
and when things go wrong, it's the top man or woman that the HSE want to speak to. And if that top man or woman, the voice of the safety person is being quashed down through all of this other business priorities, then I'm not getting to know what I need to know, and I'm not getting it untainted. That message is somehow getting diluted. So, you know, if you're a CEO, or, you know, you're the top person at the top table in that organization, I always want to have a health and safety person reporting directly into me. I want to know if my ass is exposed.
Yeah, exactly.
For one.
Exactly, yeah.
But most importantly, I want to know if I'm hurting people or putting people at risk.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like, whichever floats your boat, get a health and safety person reporting directly to you know.
And I think I've worked for several businesses that had safety reported into a director of operations, and I've been very clear that I don't agree with it. I think it's the wrong line. That doesn't necessarily mean you can't do a good job. I think some businesses might make that work, whatever. But I think what that says to me, and this is just, again, we're just talking about phrases and words, really. So, you know, we're contradicting ourselves to a point, but I think it communicates a message to me. If safety reports into operations, so let's imagine you've got operations, I don't know, we imagine a big business, so you got operations, and you've got like supporting services, and then you've got, I don't know, like finance and HR, right? They're your four sectors of a business, right? If I'm reporting it, if safety reports into operations, then that tells me that the safety doesn't apply to the other departments. Or should they have a safety person in their own department? So hang on. And that's when I think you run the risk of getting to a position where you go and talk to, say you want to talk about like stress and mental well-being. You go talk to the HR team or the finance team, you know, quite a stressful environment. So you go to the finance team, you say, how's things going? And what are you doing here, James?
Yeah, absolutely.
Come to talk about stress. Yeah, but you're operational.
Yeah, absolutely.
Health and safety doesn't apply.
Yeah, we're in our silos. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think when you bring it up to the top, I think it works because it creates that umbrella over the top, because that's why I love the job. Because one day I'm talking to the finance advisor, and the next day I'm talking to an engineer, and I have to change the way I talk and the way I listen and stuff like that. And I love that about the job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but I think if you're stuck in one department, I don't think it works. But should it sit under HR? I don't know. I think again that does the same thing. I think that means that we're just a people function. But yeah. I think we just look after people. But then if you consider what we do in risk, like I love it when a business has a director of risk. Like that's my favorite. I think that really works. Like that's really nice. Like a director of risk. That means I'm looking at more than just health and safety. That means I'm looking at how the business operates. What's a risk? Is this a risk to our brand and stuff like that? Because a lot of the time, imagine your colour brand is on BBC News and Charlie Slate and Nagamon Shetty are slagging you off on BBC News. And I think when we talk about just health and safety, I was talking about just fire safety, like the kind of brand stuff, I was just kind of laughed out the room, because we had this brand strategy team, that was their job, but they were just marketing experts. And I'm like, no, my job is risk. I can nail this stuff at risk, but I can't have those conversations because you don't let me in the room.
No, that's
the risk that you have when you kind of put safety in the wrong department, because we have some serious potential.
Yeah.
Some serious potential to help you in a business. Like listen to us. And then the flip side comes back to what I said, what we were saying earlier, is as a safety professional, don't abuse that. Like if they're listening to you, don't abuse it and be reasonable and be practicable, like you were originally designed to required to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, as you said, the important thing there is that, you know, as I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were saying to me that I do some coaching with health and safety managers and operational managers as well. And I was doing a one-to-one coaching session with somebody, and she was saying that she gets a one-to-one every month with each of the directors of the business, you know. And that's her opportunity to give them an update. And so, you know, we were going over the effectiveness of these meetings, and, you know, that she was failing really to land her messages, but also failing to get some buy-in. And she was like, you know, it's so frustrating. I sit down with them each individually for, you know, a session every month. It's supposed to be an hour. It normally goes on for an hour and a half, 2 hours, you know. And my question was, what's the percentage of talking versus listening you're doing? And it was really interesting, because she said, well, it's I present to them. So I said, all right, okay, what are you presenting? So she said, well, it's like the monthly dashboard. I go through that with them. You know, I tell them, you know, and she was doing, she was doing great. Don't get me wrong. It was great stuff. Yeah. She was doing what they had asked her to do, you know, and she does this religiously every month. So she goes in, she puts the PowerPoint either on the screen in the office or on her laptop, and she goes through it and she talks to them, and then they say, okay, and what do you need from me this month? And, you know, all right, well, I could do with you doing this or that, you know. And, you know, everyone was coming away from those meetings feeling like they were productive. But what she wasn't doing was listening. And she wasn't giving them the opportunity to talk. So I said to her, I said, look, how would it, you know, what do you think would happen if you go in this month and you say, there's the dashboard, I've printed it off for you, have a look at that in your own time, or maybe we could spend 10 minutes on it at the end of this session. But what I'd like really for you to do today is just talk to me about, you know, your job, talk to me about your department, talk to me about what keeps you awake at night. You know, these are the, and so we listed, you know, 10 or 15 questions, and she was like, okay, I think they're going to kind of say, look, if you haven't got anything important, this hour is really important, I'll claim the hour back.
Yeah,
I said,
yeah,
well, go and try it, you know, and that will tell you a lot about the leadership team that you're working for. Yeah. Either way, if they give you the bum's rush, that tells you one thing. If they talk to you for an hour, that's going to tell you a whole lot more.
Yeah.
But it means that the next time you go back and you speak to them, you can start to speak their language.
When you
leave their office, you can start to do the things and address the things that are eating their lunch. And you're not just telling them the things you think they want to hear, because our operational management, a lot of the time, they look to us as the experts. And if we go in there with a dashboard and the LTIs and the near hits and all the, then they're going to think that's what we're telling them they need to know.
Yeah.
And so I think we have a responsibility to educate these people or lead or teach them and show them what their responsibilities are, what, you know, what they need to know, what they need to do. Mm-hmm. And we can do that by listening to the things that are, you know, eating their lunch, as I tell my team, you know, just go and listen. Don't talk, go and listen.
I think that's great. And I think that it's just, yeah, there's so much gold in this, Teresa. Well, you're a legend. I should have got you on ages ago. But like this is awesome, because it's interesting that there was a conversation on LinkedIn, and it was nice because this guy put on this question around, like, his question was, how do you kind of measure safety within your business? And he said in a post, like, I don't want to hear like LTIRs or stuff like that. I don't want to hear that. Like, how do you really measure it? And I was like, wow, what a question. What a great question. And I put like a tongue in cheek comment. And sometimes I forget that it's really hard to get tone across when in text. And I should remember that, because sometimes I just look like a sarcastic asshole when actually I'm just trying to be funny.
We've all done it. We all do it. Don't worry.
But I do it like on a daily basis, and I should know better by now. But I'd put on there, like, I can't remember what I put. Oh, I put like, there's this really old borderline magical way to measure. It's called talking. Like, and it was just, but, and then like, anyway, like, people like it, and I'm just like, ah, shit, I look like this safety two disciple now. This has gone wrong. But anyway, we had this really good conversation off the back of it. The guy was like, come back, and he said, look, I'm on your side. And I was like, oh no, there is no sides. This is going
no sides. Yeah,
I don't mean that. But we got to this point where he was like, how do you, he asked me, like, okay, I get what you're saying, go and talk to your staff. I get that. Like go and ask them. So we had another comment, and I commented saying, you just go and ask them, you know, what's the risk here for you? Like, go and ask a machine operator or whatever. What's the risk? What are you dealing with? What makes your job hard? What can I do to make your job easier? What's your challenge today? Things like that, open question, and just let them, you know, let them open up on you, because they probably will. And he had a valid question, you know, okay, but how do I know that's meaningful? And I was like, okay. But I kind of don't really know how to answer that question. I'm like, well, you know, it's meaningful if you do something. So in essence, the answer to that question is, you go back and talk to them again. And or like, say Teresa's the CEO, and I tell you, right, Teresa, I want you to get rid of that clipboard, get rid of it, throw it in the bin. I want you to go down there, buy coffee for Bob, the machine operator, and just have a chat with him. They'd be like, up, Bob, you know, ask him some of these open questions. You do that, and I'm this weird safety guy from my office with my binoculars watching you. And the second you leave, like, I go back down there and I say, Bob, how was that conversation with Teresa? Like, if I can think of any way to measure it, like, that's it, just another conversation to say, how was that? And Bob might turn around and say, I don't know yet, Teresa said she's going to fix this, but we'll wait and see. Like, then a month later, we'll come back. Like, how was that conversation with Teresa? Well, she did this and this, and she couldn't do that, but she came back to me and said, I can't do this because of this, and engaged with me in a conversation. Like, that's meaningful for me. I feel like we're so desperate to have it on a chart. Like, we're so desperate to have it on a piece of paper, something we can put in a pie chart. And I understand where, because I do it as well. I do it like, how can I show we're doing a good job? Let's get some LTIs and stuff. And I think that stuff has a place. I really do think it does. It's one of the indicators. But I think there's nothing more valuable than having a committee meeting, having a board meeting, whatever, and going, right, what's the problem? What are we dealing with? let's chat.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is maybe for you, the lady you're coaching, I'd be interested to see what her response was from her board,
yeah.
from her directors. I'd be interested to see how it went. But a lot of the time, like I've done it, gone into a committee meeting and said, but I've got no charts, I've got nothing. Tell me, like, what's safe, what's not? What are we dealing with? Like, what's the problem? And everyone just kind of looks at you like, gone out. They're like, what do you want me to say, James? I'm like, just tell me about your job. Tell me what you're doing. And they just don't know what to say because they're just not used to it.
Yeah.
They're waiting yeah. for that dashboard. They're waiting yeah. for that presentation.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, that's what we've driven for me. And I know it's like oversimplification really, but as somebody now who runs her own business and it's a small business, that there are some measures that I want to know whether my business is successful. So have I made a profit? Yeah. We're not a public company, so obviously, you know, shareholder price. But if I was a big company, then I might be interested in what my shareholder price is. Am I still attracting the best talent out there? So I want some idea of, you know, who wants to come and work for me, because that tells me a lot about my business.
Yeah.
And then, you know, cash flow is really important as well. So have I got cash? Have I got enough cash to get through the next year? And are my customers really satisfied, or better still, am I exceeding their expectations? So there's five measures there, yeah, and those measures are pretty much what will tell you whether about any business, any business yeah. that I don't think they could go much beyond that, you know. A people measure, a finance measure, maybe an asset measure, you know, but there's kind of five things that we want to know that tells us ultimately, are we running a successful business? The best businesses are the ones that take those five measures and then say, well, how does safety contribute to that? Because safety does contribute to every single one of those measures. So that. If I'm killing people, nobody wants to work for me and everyone's leaving. My turnover, my attrition rate is high. People don't want to be here. If I'm not a safe organization, it's costing me, my operations are costing me money and I'm having lots of downtime on productivity. So I'm not making money and I'm not meeting my productivity targets. Yeah. I could look at my health stats and say, actually, I'm not making money because a lot of people are going sick. So I'm paying a shitload of money out in sick pay and things like that, you know. What's my reputation? Are my customers constantly complaining? Am I losing customers? Are they going to the competition? So the measures that we have already traditionally that tell us whether we're running a successful business are the only measures we need. They are the things. Yeah. It's only when you drill down from the top of them, you know, the problem. And it's so it's like the Jenga game, isn't it? You know, and we've all been on these training courses. Chris, I run them myself where, you know, you've got the team, and they're taking the bricks out from the side. You get the manager to come along and he looks down from the top and you say, everything look all right, boss? And he goes, all looks good from here. But, you know, the sides are being taken out and eventually it all crumbles. You know, we spend too much time KPI wise looking at the individual Jenga blocks that we lose sight of the big thing. And the big thing is, are we making money? Have we got share? Have we got market share? Or, you know, are we profitable? All those things that I've just talked about. And if only we could really like just make sure that, you know, our sort of KPI, the best KPI thing I've ever seen was like, it just looked like a space shuttle. And at the top it said, are we surviving or something like that? You know, are we going to make it through next year? And then everything else just sat underneath it. Everything. It wasn't like LTIs mean this. And, you know, now I know. So for me, that was like really successful. That's how that organization knew that it was performing well, which is that's the main thing. Are we performing? Are we going to survive this year? And will we be here next year? And then what they did, this I do like, because I'm a bit of a proponent for, you know, so many organizations don't manage performance well, individual performance, team performance. We sit on stuff for too long, you know, bad attitudes, bad behaviors, you know, turning up bloody late or unprepared to meetings. We just tolerate, you know, all this stuff. Actually, if then all your measures were down to individual performance and team performance rather than what's our LTI, what's this, what's that, I think that we do our leaders a good service by showing them and helping them to manage poor performance. Mm-hmm. But also all of that just combines into this big, you know, in this case, this space shuttle, which is what the business is really about, you know,
yeah.
Because at the end of the day, we're only as good as a business. We're only as good as the people who walk through that door or walk through that gate every morning.
Mm.
And if they're having a shit time or they're not performing properly for whatever reason, then we're doing them a disservice. And as a business, we're doing ourselves a disservice, I think. So, definitely. Yeah, I think we always need to measure and manage, but I think it's more down to learning how to manage individual performance as opposed to this mythical zero, you know, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, and I it's just like, you know, when I go to an organization and I say, what's your targets then? Oh, well, we want to reduce our LTI by X percent. And I say, all right, okay, so why don't you just go out? So work that out. How many people are you going to kill this month or this year? How many people are you going to have first aid? How many people are you going to go out there on the 1st of January and say, right, everyone who wants to die this year, just step forward. Everyone who wants to go to hospital, everyone who wants to get some shit in their eye or trip over a step, stand forward. Let's just get it all done in January. The rest of the 11 months is going to be a shit hot year. It's going to be great, you know, because that's what you're saying. This year, we're going to injure two people, you know. You couldn't have any other target but zero, right? Let's be pretty honest about it. You couldn't possibly, with good, you know, with a good heart and good faith, say, yeah, we're only going to kill the two people this year. Oh, I know. Can I volunteer one?
Yeah.
No organization is going to do that, but be realistic about it, you know, because the behaviors that you drive, you know, unfortunately, whether, you know, you like it or not, there was somebody on LinkedIn this week who celebrated, I'm sure you saw it because it was a bit of a Ferrari, 8 years accident free. Did you see it?
No, I actually didn't. Oh, I'd love to have seen that.
8 years. Not just lost time. 8 years accident free.
No, like shin bumps, elbow bumps.
Not a thing.
Wow.
You know, and somebody had put on there bullshit. Somebody had commented bullshit. And you know, I'm like, okay, I don't go after people like that. I try not to be too, like, you know, too antagonistic. But yeah. we kind of probably, maybe a bit unfairly, could guess the type of culture in that organization. Yeah. But the comment, the repeated comment was, Jesus, you know, I really feel for the person who has to break that record.
Yeah.
Talk about a call of shame. You know? So yeah, it's we create this world, but for me, the measures, what gets measured gets manipulated. And if we could just, you know, get our act together and say, what are the things that are really important? What do we really need to know if our business is successful? It's these four things, and everything that doesn't fall, you know, everything else that we do should contribute to those things. And if we have anything else, it's just confusion. It's just noise.
Yeah.
But let's get everyone, you know, on this.
I always kind of look at it like when you're looking at data and things like that, it's critically question the value of it. Like that for me, that's all I say. Well, what are you getting out of that chart? What are you actually getting out? You know, I've been in businesses where we've got a clear indicator of a problem, but we do nothing about it because it's maybe a gray area whether it's our responsibility or not to do it. Well, then stop measuring it then. If you're not going to do anything about it, stop measuring it because you're wasting your bloody time.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I think we do is, or we should do more of, is when we come back to that thing about talking to people, it's just back up that quantitative data with a bit of qualitative data.
Yes.
It's like, right, with less injuries, less accidents, whatever you want to measure it. And then you back that up with going down to the shop floor and you asking people, you know, how's things? What are we doing? Do you feel safe? Yeah. You know, what are the risks? Can we do anything better? And then you take those snippets and you combine the two. So critically ask yourself, what are we doing with this data? Is it delivering value to the business? If not, nip it in the bud. And I think that same question would apply to anything, your policies, your procedures, your checklist. Like, is it delivering value or not? Like, I think you could probably question every single checklist, give or take maybe about 10% of them in the workplace. Yeah. And most of them would not deliver value. They deliver checks. But that side, that's a whole different conversation. We've already been talking for over an hour and a half. So we both need our Saturday nights.
Yeah, definitely.
But that for me would be how I would leave it, is question if is that delivering value, and let's back it up with a bit of qualitative conversation for me.
Yeah.
I don't know about
unless me. Of course you're in the cockpit of a plane, then you definitely want a checklist.
Well, true. But then if all you got to do is watch Sully and he skipped the checklist. You know, he should have followed that procedure. He skipped it. He went to step 10 and he saved everyone's life.
Yeah, absolutely.
In summary, we don't have a clue what we're talking about. We're just chewing the fat and hopefully you buy some merch and, you know, we get paid for this. And hopefully you go and work with Teresa. We make money for chatting shit. And it might help you be safer. It might not. Not really sure. Yeah. But let us
know. Hopefully. It'll make you give more of a shit.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the important thing, isn't it? You know, it'll make you give more of a shit.
And if it makes you safer, let us know. And then we'll write a book about it and sell it. And we'll be keynote speakers for about 10 years. Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. And we'll contribute the proceeds to the Lighthouse charity.
I'm going to buy myself a big house.
No, definitely. No, we're all about charity over here, mate. We try and support as many as we can and give a bit back can, you know, it's important, isn't it? So we've all got a part to play.
On that note, before we leave, are you still taking donations for your hair or is that closed now?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So
I'll put the link on this podcast.
Thank you very much. Anyone listening to it
might not know that you have quite short hair because a few weeks ago it was no hair.
I was completely bald. Yeah. My ex-husband, who's here staying with me now, and my sister-in-law are both unfortunately terminally ill with cancer. It's obviously a horrible bastard disease.
Yeah.
But when your loved ones are struck down with it, you just feel so bloody helpless. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
So this was my sister-in-law, you know, was obviously losing her hair through chemotherapy, obviously not the easy way that I chose to do it.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, how can I make a difference? Because we are really reliant on Macmillan nurses and we are going to become more reliant in the coming months. And they do an amazing job. So
phenomenal.
So we're about £2,700 now in. So if we can hit the £3,000 mark, I'd be a happy girl.
You're an absolute legend for doing that. And I will put the link in the description and show notes below so people can donate. And please do, because I mean, my wife's family are absolutely plagued by it. She's lost her uncle last year. And like you say, the Macmillan nurses for him were just absolute saviors. And he said, you know, before the end of his life, you know, he wanted every penny or whatever he wanted, didn't want any money to go to him. He wanted, if you're going to give us anything, buy us anything, it goes to Macmillan nurses.
Yeah.
I think they made a fair chunk at that funeral. He was a very popular man. And now Sherry's dad and Sherry's stepmom as well have been dealing with it for years. It's a horrible, horrible, it's a bastard of a disease, like you say.
Yeah.
So please, people donate. Teresa, one last thing. Why don't you tell us about Paradigm very quickly? How can people get hold of you and stuff like that?
Yes. So they can get hold of me, Teresa, without an H, Teresa, at paradigmhp.com. You can find us on LinkedIn, at ParadigmHP, Twitter, Facebook, you name it, we're on it. Reach out to myself, Teresa Swinton, or Gareth Locke, who is fast becoming my business partner, also obviously runs the Human Diver. But either one of us will be more than happy to help you. And again, just anything at all, accidents, incidents, compliance, human performance, whatever you need some help with, we'll be glad to come and support you.
Yeah, we'll put all the links in the show notes as well. So hopefully get a bit of business out of it as well.
Brilliant. And you're going to come on my webinar soon as well, aren't you?
I am. I have no idea what I'm going to talk about after the absolute legends that you've had on it, but I'm a little bit like... Mm.
You've got plenty to say, don't you worry. And people
I've got
like
plenty
you
to say. Really ain't got no value.
It has got lots of value. Don't you believe it?
I'll just be regurgitating stuff that I've heard. So my keynotes are like, right, I interviewed Teresa and she said this was really good. I interviewed Todd and he said this and this was really good. I interviewed Adam and this was really good. And then Adam will be like, well, I was going to say that on my keynote. And yeah, well, too late, mate.
I
was first.
That's all we do, mate. We all take what we learn. We're all sponges. We all take what we learn. We pull it all together. We make some sense of it to us. And then we share it with others. And that's the beauty of what we're all doing as a community. And it's brilliant.
Like you said earlier, there's enough work out there for all of us. And it's the same with podcasts. You know, some people like my podcast, some people don't. Yeah. And if you prefer Jay Allen's podcast or Colin Knotty's podcast because of the way they talk, that's cool, man. Go over there because I want you to hear what Colin's talking about, because he talks about the same stuff as me, but he says it a little bit different. And that's exactly what we need.
Absolutely, we do.
Anyway, we're going to end up getting into a whole other conversation.
Go and enjoy your Saturday. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it, and I'll see you soon.
Yeah, you will. Thank you very much. Have a nice
night.
Take
care, darling. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Beeps, hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I absolutely love talking to Teresa. She's an absolute legend. Listen next week to hear me proper fanboy about her a little bit more. You can hear my reflection on this episode, what some of the thoughts are, and kind of my favourite points maybe, and opinions and so on and so forth. But behind the scenes, so to speak. So make sure you check out next week's episode for my reflection on my chat with Teresa. In the meantime, if you want to help us out, you want to work with us, you want to sponsor YouTube channel, you want to sponsor Health and Safety's first and only YouTuber, go to rebrandingsafety.com. You get yourself some merch. You can look at how you could work with us. You could look at even donating to us if you would like to. But more importantly, I'd like you to subscribe to our mailing list. So go to rebrandingsafety.com, scroll down to the bottom, and you'll see subscribe and put your email address in, and done. There we go. Done. Sorted. Nailed it. Thank you very much for listening. I'll catch you next week in our last interview of this Safety 1, Safety 2 mini-series. Catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.